In this age of the selfie, it's nice to know there are still plenty of people who turn their camera lenses on other people to great effect. The world still needs good photographers working with equipment more robust than a phone to communicate the human experience in pictures. Today's guest does just that. Lindsay Addario is a photographer and the author of a new, obviously illustrated memoir called It's What I Do, A Photographer's Life of Love and War. Even if you don't know the name Lindsay Addario, you may know her pictures. Her work appears regularly in the New York Times, National Geographic, and Time magazine. Her awards include a MacArthur Genius Grant and a share of a Pulitzer at the Times. Lindsay Addario, welcome to the Jefferson Exchange.
Thank you for having me.
Well, considering some of the places that you've been, you're probably lucky to be alive. You have had some close calls, we understand.
Yeah, I do think I'm very lucky to be alive, and I realize that every day.
And what are some of the close calls you've had over the years?
Well, I've been kidnapped twice. I was kidnapped in 2004 outside of Fallujah, and that was just for a day, gratefully. And then I was taken hostage again in Libya in 2011 with three colleagues from the New York Times while covering the uprising in Libya. And that was for a week. And I was in a very big car accident in Pakistan in 2009, and my driver died. And was ambushed by the Taliban in the Korangal Valley with the 173rd Airborne. So I can keep going on, but it's probably going to get boring for the readers. I mean, the listeners. So
wow. So, but I guess then the major question for anybody who's been through that much is why do it? I mean, yes, there, it's what I do. I mean, it gets right there on the cover of the book. But for you personally, what's the drive?
Well, the drive is that I see the impact of images and how important photographs are and journalism is to our society. It's a fundamental need for people to become aware of what's going on around the world. I see with the New York Times and National Geographic and Time and the publications I'm so fortunate to work for, when I have a very big story out in one of those publications, people react to it, and those pictures can educate them and educate policymakers and bring people closer to the story.
Now, I read that when you first began shooting for newspapers, you really didn't have training in particular in how to shoot for newspapers. How did that all get started?
Yeah, I never, to this day, I still haven't had any training, and sometimes I wish I had. I started photographing when I was quite young. I was about 12 or 13, and my father gave me a camera, a Nikon FG, and I started playing with it and bought a book on how to photograph and really became obsessed with the camera, but didn't understand that photojournalism was really the sort of perfect marriage between being interested in other cultures and foreign policy and political issues, and also having an artistic vision and telling those stories through photographs. So when I realized that, it was after I graduated from college at Wisconsin, and I was living in Argentina, and that's really where I started becoming more and more interested in photojournalism.
The very first paragraph in the book is about seeing dead people and not choosing to take pictures. I couldn't do it that day, you write. How often do you have days like that?
Well, it depends. I mean, more often than not, I sort of force myself to just document what I see in front of me, given that no one is objecting and that I'm being respectful. Important to just do the work and have the photos, and when I look at them with a little distance after the fact, then I can decide what to do with them. But I think the important thing is to actually take them. In the sentence in Libya where I was talking about photographing at the aftermath of a bomb, I had been working on the front line for two straight weeks and had seen so much death and so many people injured, and I really just couldn't bring myself to take a picture.
And your sense of dread was well-founded. That was the day you got kidnapped for the better part of a week. Ultimately, your job ends up being rather like emergency services, I think, in the sense that you run toward the action instead of away from it.
That's correct. I mean, there's an interesting progression in the book where when I first started working in war zones, for example, in Iraq, when a car bomb exploded next to me, I ran away from it just on instinct and just on, I reacted that way. But very quickly, soon after, I started realizing, wait, my job is not to run away, it's to run towards that. So I really, have spent the better part of the last 15 years sort of running towards places where people are fleeing.
Which kind of goes against the grain of human nature, and it sounds like even your own instincts. So you have to have a bit of a conversation with yourself sometimes, it sounds like.
Yeah, and I often am surrounded by colleagues who have a lot of experience, and we run things by each other. I mean, I think the thing that might not come across in the photographs is that often I'm not alone. I'm with a colleague, I'm with friends, I'm with a translator or a driver, I'm with people who can understand the situation, and we bounce things off of each other and really get a sense of which direction we should go.
Yeah, and not just that you're not alone, but it sounds like there's a fair amount of planning, too. In fact, you describe making sure that there's a second car when you're going into dangerous places in case the first one fails.
Yeah, I think that there are certain precautions we take and certain things that we set up, and we really try and make sure that we have a backup plan if something does go wrong. That doesn't always work out. I think, you know, sometimes we can make all the arrangements and everything goes wrong.
Across all the countries and cultures, Lindsay, do you get a little room as a journalist in the sense that you're not considered a target? I mean, often there are bullets flying nearby, if not directly around you. But, I mean, are you given some level of respect or distance just because you're there trying to document what goes on?
Well, that really depends on the country now and the situation, because when I started out 15 years ago covering conflict, I really felt like I was respected in the countries I was working in, and people really said, oh, you're a journalist, that's great, thank you for being here, thank you for your work, and thank you for telling our stories. I don't hear that as often now. I think that more often than not, especially in the Middle East and in places where there's ISIS and Al-Qaeda, journalists are taken hostage, and we're used as ransom, we're used to raise money for an insurgency, or we're used for public, to make statements publicly.
All right, so not a safe job at all, but it is what I do. It's What I Do is the title of the book by Lindsay Addario, A Photographer's Life of Love and War. We'll come back and talk more with Lindsay's experiences as a photojournalist and take your phone calls and emails as well. Back to the Jefferson Exchange with Lindsay Addario and you in a minute 25. Back on the Jefferson Exchange on the News and Information Service of Jefferson Public Radio. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. Our guest today is the award-winning photojournalist Lindsay Addario. Her work appears in Time, the New York Times, and the National Geographic, among others. You can join us on the Jefferson Exchange as we talk with Lindsay about her memoir, It's What I Do, A Photographer's Life of Love and War, 800-838-3760 throughout the listening area. And by email, jx@jeffnet.org. You say of journalists in the book, some of us are adrenaline junkies, some of us are escapists. Are you one of those categories, or you put yourself in some other one?
Well, I think that I probably don't fall into one of those categories. Maybe at certain points in my career, I became addicted to the story, not necessarily the adrenaline, but really addicted to being there and witnessing history and getting those images out there. For me, it's really about the story. So I have a very solid family life. I'm not trying to run away from anything, and I certainly feel like there are other better forms of having my adrenaline surge.
Good to know. I have to wonder, though, when you talk about experiencing history as it's being made, in the moment when you're snapping away, if you get a chance to really get a sense for that, or does that kind of rush up on you when you're looking at the pictures later for editing?
I think in certain situations you certainly get a sense for it in the moment. I mean, the things that stand out in my mind, for example, are when the Taliban fell in Kandahar. To be some of the first Western journalists in Kandahar when the Taliban fell and when Mullah Omar left. I mean, we were in there with the special forces and witnessed Mullah Omar's house, and it was really an immediacy, and we knew that what we were reporting on was going to get back to readers in the U.S., and we were really the first ones in there. And it's a very similar situation to the fall of Saddam Hussein in Iraq. I was in Iraq when he fell, and to see that elation on the streets, to witness that, to document that for readers back at home was an incredible privilege.
and seems a very long way from your beginnings in Westport, Connecticut, back to your beginnings then. Why was your family so well known in Westport?
We weren't really well known. I mean, the only thing we were known for was being a very eccentric family and having a very sort of open household, very creative household. And my parents always sort of encouraged us to go out and follow our dreams and do what we believed in. And really, we were four sisters and just had a wonderful childhood.
Your family home in the summer sounds like some kind of a movie set.
It was really fun. It was really great. We had pool parties, and both my parents are hairdressers, so full of extremely eccentric, fun people always growing up.
Did they cut most of the hair of the people in Westport? Sounds
like they did. I mean, Paul Newman and Joanne Woodward and Christopher Atkins was in there at some point. Many people. I was pretty young to understand who was who, but certainly there were people. Westport was full of creative, artistic people at the time.
Well, your dad certainly made a change in the family at age 8. What happened there?
My dad fell in love with Bruce, who is still his partner 35 years later, and he came out and they left and they started a salon together several years later and have been together since then. So I think I was 8 years old and it was probably, I was probably too young to understand exactly what was going on at that time. I just understood that my dad was leaving the family and didn't realize until several years later why he had left and that he had fallen in love with another man.
But it certainly changed the life circumstances. It sounds, again, to had to move away from the house where you had the pool for the pool parties, that sort of thing. So things changed a bit.
Things changed financially, and certainly when a divorce in any family happens, whether it's whatever the reasons, of course, that breaks a family apart. We were really lucky to have parents who showed their love throughout the entire process and were incredibly supportive and tried to keep the family back, keep the family together. Of course, there were years where that just didn't happen. My father was dealing with his own personal life and his decisions, and we were all dealing with our own lives and certainly coming of age as teenagers and going through high school, which is a tough time. So now, as we're all adults and we're all incredibly close and we take family vacations together with my sisters and my mother, my father, and Bruce all together.
Sounds fun.
Yeah.
So it was your father you mentioned who gave you your first camera at age 13. Describe the moment. Was it something like, what's this? Or was it a real level of excitement when you got it?
The exact moment, I actually didn't even remember. For a lot of this book, I interviewed my family and I interviewed colleagues and people and made sure that I got the facts straight. But I remember having a Nikon FG and spending night after night sitting on the roof trying to photograph the moon and reading about photography and the shutter speed and light. But the precise moment in which he handed me the camera, my father explained that to me, and he remembered it very vividly. I was out at his house. This was after my parents had separated, and I was at his house, and there was a camera sort of that one of his clients had given him, and it was lying around his house, and I saw it, and I said, "What is that? Can I see it?" And he sort of just handed it to me and very quickly understood that I felt connected to it. And he said, "Well, just keep it." And that sort of started everything.
Now, we're the lucky ones, those of us old enough to have been in film dark rooms. So what was that like? You mentioned some darkroom experiences in your teens. That sounds fascinating.
Incredible. I mean, I'm so, so grateful that I started out with film, because I think that it was such a beautiful thing to go into the darkroom and actually process film and print film and watch the image come up under the red light in a darkroom. And so when I first started shooting with film, it was very expensive, of course. So I, as a young woman, had to save my money for every roll of film and processing it. And then a friend of my mother's who was a photographer, she had a darkroom in her house, and she was a professional photographer. So she took me in and said, "I'll teach you how to print and how to process." And so she did, and I ended up spending night after night when I was in high school in her darkroom.
I chuckle sometimes to think about shooting back then. Can you imagine trying to hold yourself to 36 pictures at a time?
No, never. I know. Now I go on assignment and sort of the minimum I shoot is 6,000, 7,000.
Wow.
Yeah.
Which would have been just multiple rolls of film back then.
I mean, it's incredible because I work a lot for National Geographic, and often the sort of two trips, three trips, it's 60,000 photos.
Wow.
Yeah.
So do you kind of edit as you go? I mean, do you grab things on a laptop right away and start looking at the ones that need to just go away right now?
Well, no, I do. It depends how intensive my shooting days are. I mean, often when I'm working for Nat Geo, I'm up at 4:30 and I'm shooting till 9 o'clock at night. So I definitely don't have time to edit. It's I'm downloading, and I know in my head, and I know when I'm out there, when I'm in a moment that is poignant or that I feel like it's all coming together. And so I'll remember that and sort of mark a few photos. But then I don't really do the editing until I come home and I'm sitting in my house. And I'm sort of sequestered away for a good few weeks.
So given the fascination with photography in your teens and the joy of working in the dark room, was there just some sort of like, can you make a buck at it sort of thing that led you to go to UW-Madison for international relations rather than think about photography as a career?
Yeah, I guess I never considered photography. I never took it seriously. It never seemed like it could be a profession, and I actually really loved studying. I loved international relations and politics and cultures, and so I just had never been introduced to a photojournalist, so I wasn't familiar with the profession, and it wasn't until I went to Wisconsin, I was still interested in photography, but wasn't really shooting anymore. I spent a junior year in Bologna studying in Italy, and there I started doing more and more street photography, I think because I had the time and I was anonymous, so I felt comfortable sort of going out on the street shooting. And then when I graduated from Wisconsin, all I wanted to do was photograph.
Lindsay Addario is our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. Her book is It's What I Do, A Photographer's Life of Love and War. She has covered quite a few wars in her time and paid some prices for it physically. You can join us on the Jefferson Exchange, 800-838-3760, anywhere in the listening area, 800-838-3760. Email address is jx@jeffnet.org. So it's an interesting concept. So you were anonymous. Nobody knew you in Bologna. So what were some of the early subjects there?
I did a lot of street photography there. I mean, I really felt like, for me, it was one of the first places where I would actually go up to people on the street as a total stranger. And for some reason, I didn't have the courage to do that back at home. So that was really one of the places where I started exploring photographing people and photographing strangers.
And how did most of them treat you when you first went? I mean, you obviously have developed a good approach over time because it's just amazing how physically close you can get to some of the people who are the subjects of your photographs. But was it just sort of a natural thing to you, or did you have to work on it?
Of course I had to work on it because it was such a new thing. I mean, now, you know, sometimes if I don't photograph for a month, which for me is a really long time, I have this fear that, oh my God, what if I walk into an assignment and I can't figure out how to approach people? But it's such a natural part of who I am and how I work that never actually happens. You know, I'm constantly walking in and out of people's most intimate moments, you know, so I think a lot of what I'm doing is just trying to make them feel comfortable before I even take my camera out.
We have a call here from Jamie in Medford. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Lindsay Addario, the author of It's What I Do. Hi, Jamie.
Good morning, Jeffrey. Well, Lindsay, I too, many decades ago, I had the opportunity to have a mentor of sorts, and basically what we did was we played with black and white photography from shooting normally with single lens and double lens reflex lenses, and processing the film and developing it and also enlarging it and cropping it in a dark room situation. So I really appreciate that. One of my favorite heroes of photography is Ansel Adams.
Mm-hmm.
And that leads me up to my question, which is, Lindsay, have you ever worked with a large format camera work, like particularly with National Geographic work? And if so, what was your experiences with that particular type of equipment? And I'll take the
No, you know, I've never actually worked with large format. I always work with 35 because my job is sort of always on the run, and I need a sort of small camera that I can move and shoot very quickly with. I have an old Rolleiflex that my sister gave me, but I actually never use it because I use my Nikon so much. The only other format I've experimented with is a wide lux, which is a panoramic camera, which is 100 and I think 20 or 40 degrees, and the lens actually moves around the camera.
Wow. Have you ever considered doing any video work, or have you done some already?
Yeah, I've done some video work. I haven't learned formally again, once again.
Still waiting for a coach, yeah.
Some of this stuff. So, but that is something I would like to do more of. I've done three or four professional videos where I've sort of been on an assignment and I think to myself, this needs to be a longer story and this needs to be a story with sound and moving picture. And I'll just start shooting, but I don't really have the proper training. I'm not getting all the shots I'm supposed to be getting, for example.
Well, some of the stuff like composition and those sorts of things just transfer straight over. You know, a good shot is a good shot.
Yeah. Well, there's some setup shots and stuff that I feel like I always miss.
The establishing shots, yes, all that
yeah,
stuff.
Yeah, exactly. That's what it's called.
the places you've traveled around the world, you talked about doing some university time in Bologna, and then you ended up doing your first newspaper work in Argentina, in Buenos Aires. And it sounds like you've always gravitated toward people affected by wars. Tell us about shooting Las Madres on the plaza there in Buenos Aires.
Well, that was really my first sort of attempt at shooting something that was sensitive, in the sense that I saw these women and they had such pain in their faces and such torment in their heart, clearly. And every Thursday, I think it was, they would march around the Plaza de Mayo and I would watch them. And suddenly I just thought, I should try and photograph that and see if I can capture that emotion that they have. And that was really the first time, and I just kept going back every week and trying to make a really good picture. And I one of those pictures ended up in the Buenos Aires Herald, and of course I look at it now and I think, oh my God, that's such a bad picture. But you know, I thought that I was doing something really poignant and that I was really making that definitive picture. So I think I think really it's about going back and keep and trying over and over. And then after Argentina, I started working in Cuba in 1997, and I went back to Cuba every year for about 5 years. And in 2000, I started working in Afghanistan under the Taliban, and that was really, really probably the most challenging thing I had done to date.
Let's come back to Buenos Aires, though, because the story of how you actually got the job with the Buenos Aires Herald is a fun one.
So I kept going into the Buenos Aires Herald, and there were two men who I think they were probably in their 40s, I guess around 40s, and they would sit every time I would go to the paper. They were chain smoking cigarettes and just sitting in the photo department, and I kept saying, can I have a job? And they said, no, you don't have any experience. And I kept going back, and so they said, well, go learn Spanish and come back. So I went and I learned Spanish and I went back, and then finally they said, okay, look, Madonna is filming Evita at the Casa Rosada, and if you can get, talk your way onto the set and get pictures of her and get the picture in the newspaper, then we will give you a job for the rest of the year. And I just said, okay. So I went to the cordon, there's always a cordon around the movie set, and I went, and there were sort of bouncers from New York, and I just said, look, let me explain to you that my entire career depends on you. And if you let me in and if I can take a picture of Madonna, I'm going to get my first job. And they were just like, okay, go. And so I got onto the set and I got onto the press riser. And when I got on, I realized we were miles away from Madonna. I mean, we were so far. And I had this tiny little Nikon camera that obviously with a 50-millimeter lens. And so I stood there on the press riser sort of totally crestfallen and just depressed. And this other journalist, this other photographer just tapped me on the shoulder and said, hey, kid, give me your camera back. And I took my lens off my camera, and he took my Nikon camera back and put it on his Nikon lens that was like, must have been like a 600 or I don't know what. And there was Madonna. And I could see. And so I started squealing and took a few pictures and then ran back to the newsroom and got a picture in the paper.
Wow. I could just imagine the difference, though. And you describe it well in the book. Whoa, there's Madonna.
Yeah.
Very
and it
big.
Was funny. I was so nervous when I went back to the photo lab at the newspaper that I couldn't even spool the film. My hands were shaking so much. And that's something I had done a million times in high school, but I couldn't do it. So I had to go out and ask someone in the newsroom to help me.
So tell us about some of the people who helped you there in Argentina and then later on when you went to New York.
You know, in Argentina, actually, there were not many people who helped me, I would say. It was a lot of, it was a difficult time in Argentina, and I just, there were not many people who helped me out. I have an ex-boyfriend who was with me at the time, and he himself had just finished a journalism program at Columbia, and he was incredibly instrumental in guiding my career. But in terms of having other photographers, it was very difficult. And I really didn't find mentors until I moved back to New York. And there were people at the Associated Press in New York who really took me under their wing and essentially taught me how to photograph.
So you were working as a stringer for the AP then, which didn't really pay the bills. What were you doing for money otherwise in New York?
I was working at a shirt company, Craig Taylor Shirts, and I was assisting sort of the second in command of that company, and she would give me jobs, and I could do them on my free time, and I was a waitress.
Okay, it sounds like a fairly typical New York living for the time.
Yeah.
Lindsay Addario is our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. Her memoir is It's What I Do, A Photographer's Life of Love and War. We'll talk about some of the dangerous places she has taken her craft and has taken some amazing pictures. Back on the Jefferson Exchange with Lindsay Addario and your phone calls and emails in a minute 25. Final segment on today's Jefferson Exchange. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. Our guest today is the photojournalist Lindsay Addario. Her work appears in the New York Times, Time Magazine, National Geographic, you name it. Her awards include a MacArthur Genius Grant and a share of a Pulitzer for international coverage at the New York Times. Her memoir is It's What I Do, A Photographer's Life of Love and War, and she has seen plenty of both. You can join us on the Jefferson Exchange at 800-838-3760 throughout the listening area or by email jx@jeffnet.org. We were just talking about working in New York and having to do some other jobs in addition to working as a stringer for the Associated Press. Interesting deal you made with your father to get yourself properly equipped, Lindsay. Tell us about that.
So in my early 20s, my three older sisters were all getting married, and I knew that all I cared about at that point was photographing and photography and trying to break my way into this profession. And I still didn't have any money for proper cameras, and I was working literally every hour of the day. And so I went to my father and Bruce, and I made a proposal, and I said, you know, for each of my sister's weddings, you give X amount of money, and how about if you front me the wedding money, presume I'm getting married now, front me the wedding money, and when I do get married 10, 15 years from now, I won't ask you for any money. So that was the proposal. And they did it, and I bought my first cameras.
Excellent. So where did you go with them then? You talked about Cuba, but you also ended up going to India at some point?
Yeah, I moved to India, actually. That was, and frankly, I think without that, I'm not sure I could have done it because photography is so expensive, and it's a really hard profession to buy all the equipment you need to get started. So I moved to India in 2000. A family friend was taking a group of students to India. And he said, why don't you come along? It's a good chance for you to see more of the world. And I started emailing contacts at the Christian Science Monitor, New York Times, the Associated Press, saying, do you need a stringer in India? And in fact, many people wrote back and said, yeah, if you base yourself there, we could use you. And so I ended up staying, and that sort of was my first official overseas posting.
Is there any country better for a photographer? And I ask this because I just think of how many people there are. For somebody who photographs people, there are so many people and so much color and so much variety.
It's an incredible, incredible place for photography. And Indians are lovely in the sense that they are so open and they're relatively peaceful. I mean, I rarely felt like people would get angry at me for taking out my camera. And most people are very open to being photographed. And the colors and light, it's just extraordinary.
So was it from India you made your first trip to Afghanistan?
Yes, I was renting a room. I rented a room from the Dow Jones bureau chief, Ed Lane. And he, like so many journalists based in India at the time, was covering Afghanistan under the Taliban. And the Taliban was giving visas, actually, to come in and to show the world that they had brought stability to the country. And so he came home from a trip and he said, you know, you're a woman and you care about women's issues and you should go to Afghanistan and photograph how women are living under the Taliban. And I remember thinking at the time, you know, that's a really good idea. Why not? It never dawned on me that, oh, my God, this would be a horribly dangerous assignment because in my, you know, all the journalists around me were also covering Afghanistan. And obviously they wouldn't recommend it if it was a crazy thing to do.
But did you have any particular concern? I mean, I'm just trying to figure out what the status of women at that time in under the Taliban was pretty poor.
Well, of course. I mean, my main concern was that I was a woman. I was a single woman. That I didn't have a male guardian. And all women at that time under the Taliban had to have a male guardian with them in public. Generally, those rules are different for journalists than they are for the local population. So Ed suggested I get in touch with the UN, who was still operating there, and some smaller NGOs to see if they could escort me around. And that's exactly what I did. I ended up linking up with CDAP, which was a landmine organization, and UNHCR. And both organizations offered to take me around. And then the Taliban itself assigned me, literally assigned me, a man to walk around with me on the streets of Kabul.
How was that relationship?
Well, you know, a lot of these guys, the only people they could get to be minders are people who had been abroad because they learned some English. And so once I had an Afghan who had lived in Australia for many years, and he was wonderful. We had a lot of fun, actually. In fact, we got stopped by the Vice and Virtue, which was the toughest arm of the Taliban that would go around and force Sharia law. We were walking on the street in public, and we were laughing, and we got stopped by a truckload of Taliban saying, who is this? Is your wife? Is this your wife? Why are you laughing and why are you out in public?
Huh. Those are things that people could get whipped for that time, couldn't they?
Yeah. I mean, it was, you know, extremely dangerous, obviously. And we were spared. I mean, they just said, okay, you know, obviously stop, you know, and we were let go. They said, what are you doing? And I said, I'm photographing. And I said, I'm a journalist. And I had my accreditation and paperwork. And obviously I had been to meet with the ministry, the Taliban ministry. So once they saw that all of that was in order, they asked for the film in my camera, which ironically was that panoramic film, that panoramic camera I was talking about. Uh-huh. And by the time I rewound it, they were moving their car to the other side of the roundabout, their truck, and I was able to slip that roll of film down into my bra, and I handed them an empty roll of film.
Oh, wow. So the film survived.
Yeah.
trying to give us some sense of and you'd seen different cultures, different places by that time, certainly, about whether Afghanistan was really that much different from any other place you'd seen, and if so, how?
It was extraordinarily different from any place I had ever seen. I think I'm not sure it's that much different than it was. It's that much different now than it was then, but it was different from any place I'd ever seen, if that makes sense. It was completely cut off from the rest of the world because under the Taliban, there was no TV, no radio. Oh, sorry, there was radio. There was no TV, no forms of entertainment. So song and dance and any entertainment was essentially banned under the Taliban. So it was almost a silent country. When I would walk on the streets of Kabul, there were very few cars. There were only beggars on the streets. There was no development. The infrastructure was shattered. The hospitals had no doctors, no medicine. There were only a few midwives working to help deliver babies, for example. I felt like I was going back 1,000 years in time when I was in Afghanistan.
So obviously, great curiosity coming from you, but you got a fair amount coming back, it sounds like. Did people quiz you often about life in America?
Yeah, I mean, I only wish that they would ask me more at that time. I think people were so shy about asking those questions. And frankly, this is before September 11th, so there was very little interaction between the U.S. and Afghanistan in 2000. And when I left Afghanistan after having worked there three times under the Taliban, I couldn't give my pictures away. I mean, only the L.A. Times printed a few because Dexter Filkins, who was then working for the L.A. Times, who's now at the New Yorker, he was also going to Afghanistan, and they needed some photos. But other than that, no one cared about my pictures, and no one would print them. And it wasn't until after September 11th that that curiosity began.
And you write of how much September 11th essentially changed your life. And so where were you, and how did you respond?
So I was living in Mexico City at the time when September 11th happened, and I moved there in March of 2001, and I just wanted to get on the first plane and go back to the region because I felt so close to that region and Afghanistan and Pakistan, and I had covered it so extensively while I was living in India. So I, like many journalists, got to Pakistan very, very quickly after September 11th and ended up there, I think, on the 21st of September. And was lucky to get my first proper assignment with the New York Times, and was covering sort of the lead up to the war in Afghanistan.
So essentially 9/11 and the aftermath turned you into a war photographer?
I think so, yeah. It wasn't what I set out to do. I mean, I never sort of had fantasies of being a war photographer growing up. I never, ever would have thought that growing up in Westport that I would end up covering war. I think it just, one thing led to another, and the stories I was interested in happened to be in war zones or on the periphery of war, and I just kept going back to those stories because I felt comfortable in those places and I was familiar with the culture.
Let us take a call. We have Jeff in Ashland on the line. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Lindsay Addario. Her book is It's What I Do.
Hello.
Hi.
I've been into photography quite a bit myself, and I wanted to ask a couple questions about the particular cameras. Like the very first camera, I think you described it as a Nikon TN.
FG.
What?
FG.
FG.
Nikon F with a TN meter or a Nikomat with a...
It was an F, like Frank, G for, I don't know, G for... Can you help me out?
G as in George. How's that?
George.
And so what?
It was all manual.
Mm-hmm. All right. So no automatic stuff. Everything. Yeah, and it was all film, obviously, still at that time.
All film.
So when did you make the transition to digital?
After September 11th. Right after September 11th, I flew to New York on one of the first flights to New York from Mexico City. And I had an agency at the time, Saba. And Marcel Saba, who was the owner of the agency, handed me a Canon digital camera, and I had never shot Canon in my life. And he said, here's the manual, here's the camera, and one wide-angle lens. I think it was a 17 to, I don't know, 35, I don't remember. And he said, learn how to use the camera on the plane and file when you get there.
Wow.
Yeah. So I did.
So did you end up switching back to Nikon for digital
so
you could use your old lenses?
In fact, I kept, I brought my film camera with me, my Nikon gear, and I had the Canon digital, and I sort of slowly transitioned, and then Nikon initially didn't have as good cameras as Canon, I think, in the beginning, and so I switched to Nikon as soon as a good camera came out, digital.
We haven't really talked that much about the trade-offs you had to make in order to become the photographer you became. You were leaving a lot of life behind at times, and so tell us about some of the things you missed or missed out on.
Well, I think that, you know, I think anyone who is a professional and who wants to be successful makes a lot of personal sacrifices. And the difference with this job is that it was so unpredictable. And so unlike a businessman, for example, who can say, honey, I'm going away for a week and I'll be back, I could never do that. And so I often would pack my bags and have no idea. You know, for example, when I went to northern Iraq at the end of February in 2003, we all thought Saddam Hussein would fall at some point, but we had no idea when. And once I entered into northern Iraq from Iran, there was no way out until Saddam fell, because none of us had visas back into Iran, and we literally had to wait. So that was a matter of, I was gone for about 3 months. And so naturally, my boyfriends left me. I missed the birth of my sister's children. I missed my best friend's weddings. I missed everything because I had no stability in my life for so many years.
We should point out you are married with a child now and living in London.
You should point that out. Yes. In 2005, I met my husband, and we were friends for a very long time before we got together. And he was well aware of the work I'm doing and my lifestyle. And he had no interest in changing me and in trying to mold my life into something that was convenient for him. And so he himself was a journalist, and he understood the demands of my work.
So are your overseas assignments a little fewer and farther between now?
Yeah, now that I have a son, I have a 3.5-year-old son, Lucas. And so I take, I still work a lot, but I generally limit my assignments to no more than 2 weeks at a time. And I'm gone usually half the month, I would say.
Does your life ever give you whiplash, Lindsay? You write in the book, for example, about going from a burqa in Afghanistan to a bikini on a beach in Mexico in pretty short order.
Yeah, that was very odd. Does it give me whiplash? No. I mean, I think it's how I've lived for the last 20 years. So it's basically all I know. I think sometimes when I'm in one place, for example, when I was pregnant and I couldn't travel after 34 weeks until, Lucas was about 5 weeks old, that was the longest I think I'd ever been in one place in my entire adult life.
Wow.
Yeah, I mean, and I traveled after Lucas, 5 weeks after I gave birth. I went to Norway to the Nobel Peace Center, and I that was like the longest I'd ever been in one place.
So what's the last place you went, and what's the next place you're going?
So I got back on Friday from Sicily. I was doing a story on the migrants. Last fall, I spent a good month or so working on the African and Middle Eastern migrants who were trying to get to Europe. And I was lucky to get on a ship with the Italian Navy doing rescues, but this time I was not so lucky.
Mm. And is that the place you're going back to?
No, I actually am coming to the States next week to give talks.
Oh. Well, we're glad we had a chance to get a preview with you. The book is called It's What I Do, A Photographer's Life of Love and War. Lindsay Addario shot the pictures and wrote the text, and she's joined us today. Lindsay, thank you so much.
Thank you so much for having me.
All right, take care.